Few questions are more important to our existence than UFOs. If aliens are truly piloting these crafts, then everything we think we know about the world gets turned upside down. Of course, maybe you think that's nonsense. And you wouldn't be alone. After decades of sci-fi films, many still dismiss it as a fantasy. Others swallow conspiracies whole. And maybe you're here because you're trying to figure out what to believe. The middle road, though, the one that rejects both gullibility and cynicism, is almost never walked. That's a road where we hold nuance, examine the evidence with academic rigor, and ask what it means for our lives. So here are the facts. A network of the world's brightest scientists has been studying this in silence. And in 2021, the Pentagon admitted what millions already suspected, UFOs are real. From 2023 to 2024, US authorities received 757 UFO reports, and about 21 of those remain unexplained and are under further investigation. Taken together, the picture that emerges isn't just strange, it's destabilizing. But to do the subject justice without sliding into conspiracy, we knew we needed the right guide, someone who has lived on the middle road. That's why we turned to Diana Walsh Pazulka. Over the last decade, she has become something of a national treasure. A professor at the University of North Carolina, she was one of the first scholars to approach the UFO question not to prove or dismiss, but to understand. Her two books quickly became essential texts. She has infiltrated the secret society of scientists, and she has interviewed those who claim direct encounters. Diana has earned trust in spaces few are allowed to enter, and in doing so, she's become the leading voice for anyone brave enough to ask what these phenomena might mean. If you're new to Mighty Pursuit, we exist to help you make sense of the whole person, mind, body, and spirit, not as vague wellness cliches, but as deeply interconnected parts of your everyday experience. We believe putting the whole person back together is the key to living well. Today's episode zooms into our truth category, where we explore the biggest questions about the nature of reality, the possibilities of other dimensions, and what this all means for how we should live. This is one of the most comprehensive explorations of UFOs you'll ever see. We connect the dots with clarity, cut through the noise, and ask the questions others are afraid to touch. By the end, you may find yourself making some shocking connections between UFOs and many of the other strange phenomena now entering the mainstream. So let's begin.
Diana, in your second book, you describe someone you call the Gray Man, a pseudonym you gave to a career scientist who still isn't publicly on the record. But back in 1994, he reported seeing an object flying low over the trees in Australia. So can you explain to me what happened to him that night?
Sure. So this is the Brisbane Waters UFO flap that happened in Australia during that time. And it was witnessed by many people. Probably like 100 people. And the witnesses were, they varied from ordinary people to police officers and, you know, trained observers and people like that. So this man is a surfer and like a lot of people in Australia. And so he was on his way to his friend's house and he was driving along at night. And he said, as he was driving, he saw something that he thought was a meteor. But he said that it didn't act like a meteor.
Welcome to Pod Summarizer. Summarize your favorite podcasts. Dive into the intriguing world of UFO flaps, where credible scientists investigate mysterious sightings, revealing a hidden network of researchers dedicated to unraveling the unknown phenomena of our skies.
It's a really interesting UFO flap. By the way, a flap is when a UFO over a few days occurs in one location and multiple people see it. So there's been many, many UFO flaps. So that was a well-known one. And there's a lot of researchers in Australia, Keith Basterfield and Moira, I can't remember her last name, excuse me, Moira, but a great ufologist. These are people who study UFOs. They both have done work on that flap. I think almost every ufologist in Australia has probably looked at that. So that was a well-known flap, and that's what he identifies as his first experience.
The Gray Man, who the pseudonym, is just so interesting because for everything surrounding who he was, and like, so he's a scientist who runs a major lab, right?
Yes.
Works at a major research agency, and yet he stays anonymous and was anonymous in your book. So he doesn't want to be known. And he's part of this group of people that you call the Invisible College, scientists, engineers that study this phenomenon in secret, people with high credentials, reputation. And so when I first learned about this group, it was very shocking to me because you hear about these sightings and you think it's kooky people that are like seeing these things. And then as soon as I opened up your first book, it was like, wow, extremely smart people are researching this. And there's like a secret society that's happening, which sounds conspiracy, but it's actually real. So can you explain to me like what the Invisible College actually is and how you found your way into that?
Yeah, sure. So, okay. First off, you have to understand that I also thought this was kooky, and it was never my intention to study the topic of UFOs, which are now called UAP, Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena. It happened because of studying religious – I'm a religious studies professor. So what I do is I study the history of religion. And in the history of religion, people have extraordinary events happen to them. They see angels or they pray to for souls to go to purgatory, say they're Catholic and things like that. So my specialty has been looking at the ascent narratives, basically people believing that, you know, they are – well, let's take a good example. So Dante's Divine Comedy is an ascent narrative. So he's talking about a journey that he's taking through heaven, hell, and purgatory. So within the culture of the West, we have these ascent narratives. So my specialty was looking at those and other world journeys. So after I was finished doing that, I studied a lot of aerial phenomena in the Catholic historical record. And in about 2011, 2012, I started to get correspondence from people in aerospace communities who did not know each other, but I'd get like it happened pretty often, and I started to wonder, why are they looking at my research? And they wanted to know, do I have what data I had and so forth. And so my perspective was completely historical and academic, in the sense that I wasn't approaching these as things that were real objectively. I was approaching them as cultural phenomena, may or may not be real. Okay. So we have to get that straight. That's my method. And it's not the method of the people who approached me who were in the aerospace community. So they were looking at these as if they were real. And that was, that shocked me, because I thought, what you're looking at, historical angel events or historical aerial phenomena as if it was, something real and not something like a weather phenomena or something. And they said, yes, we are.
Having recognized the cultural impact of historical perceptions, the conversation now shifts to the unexpected camaraderie found among astronauts and pilots, revealing the deeper complexity surrounding their silence on unidentified aerial phenomena.
It was us in Russia, and we were like, we may have fought on the ground, but we were bonded in space. And so I think that other people get to see what's in space. And so we better come clean and say, okay, yeah, there might be things in space we don't know about. Maybe that.
Yeah. I mean, the aviation and the space thing, that had to rank at maybe top three for me of like most surprising things that I read, which, the idea of reading that, like astronauts are essentially signing in NDAs of unable to fully discuss what they've experienced in space. I don't know how much you could say about this, but why do you feel like there's that culture of silence with aviation?
Okay, so this is really interesting. So there's a huge culture of silence within not just, not just for astronauts, but for pilots as well. And, people like Ryan Graves, who is a pilot, and my friend E.O. Whiteley, they've helped try to cure that situation within aviation, right? So when pilots see things, they want flight time. Like, that's their job. But if they see things that are unidentified, people question their sanity. And that's bad for flight time, because they could be demoted. They could, their flight time could be zero, right? And they're discouraged from talking about it. All right. So apparently, and I didn't know this either, actually. So when I was first doing the study with Tyler, who is a mission controller, so he knows a lot of astronauts, and he was with his friend who's an astronaut, And they were having this conversation, and they said something about NDAs. And I thought, NDA, you know, celebrities have people sign NDAs. Yeah. And I said, what's that about? And Tyler said, well, you know, astronauts see things in space. And, you know, so now I understand. Like, of course I was shocked because most people don't know that. But it makes perfect sense because, you know, again, it's a lot of national security type of thing that's happening. So they're going to have to sign NDAs. It's part of being, you know, in a program that has, you have to have a clearance for, it's a special, you know, special people get to do it. You have to train your whole life really to do this. So it makes sense to me now. But at the time, I thought it was very strange.
Yeah. I mean, so when you shake the body of all of that stuff, and when I was going through your research, I mean, the scientists, the engineers, the government, the aviation, the astronauts, all of this stuff, it was like, and even your personal story coming into the subject, I'm like, okay, there's so many people that are in very smart fields that are not government and all these places that are taking this very seriously. And it seems like people should take this like very seriously. And I think that as we get into like the phenomena itself and like what people actually like report seeing, it's interesting because it's like very, in some ways, different from sci-fi movies and other things that are being said. So, with all that in mind, I just want to go straight into like the facts basically of what people believe that they're seeing or report that they're seeing, because the implications of that would be huge. And so after reading your book, it seemed like there were basically three pieces of this phenomena that may or may not be connected. So let's just start with the first one since we've already alluded to that, which is the aerial phenomena piece of this. And so what actually sets the UFOs apart, or UAPs, what they're calling it now, from any other aircraft in terms of how they move and how they seem to defy the laws of physics? Because I think that would really help people understand why the government or the Pentagon would be saying, well, there's 20 of these in 2024 that we can't really figure out what's...
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. So generally, when we look up and we see satellites or we see airplanes, we see a linear trajectory, right? We see the direction in which it goes, and it's straight, it goes one way. It's not making erratic moves. It's not turning on a dime. It's not moving up and down. It's not moving toward us. Okay, so these are the kinds of movements that pilots are witnessing and people that see UFOs. They witness UFOs dancing around, sometimes often, sometimes splitting apart and going back together. So these are obviously non-ordinary. And we don't have planes, even drones make movements that are not like planes, but not like that. They go at speeds that are really in excess of, you know, what we think we have, you know, in terms of our technology now. So those kinds of things.
As the peculiar movements of these unidentified objects linger in thought, the narrative shifts to a gripping personal account of an encounter that created a profound impact, revealing hidden connections that emerge.
And so it's, you know, it kind of frightened them, although he didn't say that he was frightened. He's a macho guy. So he didn't say he was frightened, but he said that it, you know, they were pretty concerned. Maybe it was a submarine or some type of weapon that they didn't know about, right? So they were, you know, this is a pretty serious situation. Well, once it got under them, the ship completely lost all electric. They couldn't do anything with their electricity. And so they were stationary. They couldn't move for 4 hours. And then it went away. And
it just went away.
Yeah, it just went away. It just moved on. And then they, you know, they were okay after that. And so he talked about that. And it was one of those things that as a kid you remember, because it was so strange. So as a kid, I remembered that. And then even after American Cosmic, I didn't think about it, even after I wrote American Cosmic. But what happened was Tim Gallaudet started to talk about the USOs. And I thought, whoa, I think my dad actually had that experience. And when I listened to the data from the people that he interviewed, I recognized it as being very similar, as being like a pattern match. So I asked my brothers about it. Do you guys remember like when dad talked about this thing that he saw? And they had better memories than me, you know? And so we all pieced it together and actually told Tim about it. And so that does happen.
That's so fascinating. I mean, the fact that it's happening in the sea, I can't even imagine how startling that would be for your father for that to be happening.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I alluded to this, but just to make it clear for people. So since 2021, the Pentagon has released a report every year. So I think if I'm getting this correctly, in terms of the numbers, last year, at least from the middle of 2023 to the middle of 2024, they had received 767 reports of aerial phenomena. And they identified 21 out of that as things they could not immediately identify as, I guess, ours or whatever way you want to put this. So if you look at that report specifically, I think that says a lot of things because, first of all, a lot of people are right when they say, okay, a lot of these things are not actually UFOs or UIPs and all of that stuff. And that it's something else that's happening there. So there's validity to that. But when there's also validity to the fact that a smaller subset of this, they couldn't identify these things. So when they say they can't identify, does that mean that they fit into these sort of patterns, the USOs, the going to the sea, the physics? Is that really what they're referencing when they say they can't figure it out right now?
They say that they're anomalous. So anomalous would include all those things that we talked about, like submersives. And
what does anomalous mean?
Okay, anomalous is it doesn't fit into any known pattern. So it's outside of the patterns that we associate with aerial phenomena.
Okay. So is there significance behind the fact that they change the name from UFOs to UAPs?
Yes.
Why?
Okay, so, well, first off, UFOs have so much baggage, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, what's a stereotypical UFO? It looks like a disc craft and, you know, little gray beans come out of it kind of thing, right? Okay, so they want to disassociate UAP from that idea because really—
With the understanding of how the shift from UFOs to UAPs aims to redefine perceptions, attention now turns to an intriguing encounter in New Mexico that reshaped beliefs about aerial phenomena.
Site in New Mexico, we spoke about this with Dr. Gary Nolan, and you mentioned the other person was a pseudonym, has a pseudonym of Tyler. And so can you explain like what happened there and what you guys found?
Yeah, sure. So this was early on, you know, in my study, and I wasn't a scoffer, but I was a disbeliever, absolutely. And I wanted to know why, you know, I'm looking at the belief in modern aerial phenomena, why people believe they're UFOs and so forth. And so here you have two subjects that were excellent. You know, they were well-known scientists, very credible. And so Tyler had asked me if he knew I didn't believe. And so he had said to me, you should come, you know, to a place and I think it might change how you think about this. Right now, you just think that it's, you know, in the imagination and that it's not actually physical. And I couldn't argue with him. I was like, that's right. And so he asked me to go to this place in New Mexico, a crash site, he said. And it wasn't Roswell, he said. It was another one because he said there were several happened during the 1940s, which of course I thought, it just doesn't make sense to me, but okay, I'll go, right? But I didn't want to go by myself because I thought that was kind of scary, frankly. Mm-hmm. Plus, I had to be blindfolded to go to the place. And so I asked a friend of mine who's a colleague in religious studies, and he said, it's out of my comfort zone. I don't think I want to do that. And I thought, okay, I'll ask Gary because I had just met Gary and I had seen a couple of his presentations to small groups about his hobby, which is studying UFOs. Immediately, he was like, let's go. So he was very excited to go. So I had to convince my friend though. I said, look, this guy, he's a Stanford professor. I think you'll want him to go because if we find anything, which I was dubious we would, but if we find anything, at least he would be able to analyze it. He's got all the cool equipment and so forth. So apparently he did his due diligence and he came back and he said, sounds good, let's go. So we all went, okay? And we were blindfolded and Tyler drove. He'd been at this site many, many times before. So this is part of his what he called his hobby job, which was looking at these parts and finding people to do analysis, like material studies analysis of them and things like that. So, you know, it was in New Mexico, pretty high up, I guess, and we had to wear boots because there were rattlesnakes there. And we had all this equipment that he had configured, you know, metal detector equipment and things like that. So I was just going as an observer doing this book, which they knew about because I was very transparent with them. And I said, I am writing this book about this belief, this emerging belief. It looks like a religion to me. And you guys look like the priests. And I'm doing this and I hope that's okay. And they were like, let's do it. All right. So we were all on the same page. Me, the disbeliever, them wanting to get their hands on this stuff. So we go out there and we do find stuff. But, you know, it's not like out there everywhere. And another thing is that there was a lot of rubble out there. So it took us about 3 hours to get there from the place where we already were, which was fairly, I thought, remote. So we get there and this place is filled. Once we get the blindfolds off, I look around and the place is filled with this rubble. And Tyler noticed that I was looking and he's like, this is old. These are old cans that have disintegrated from the 1950s when the military came out here. And they put all these, they wanted the, you know, they didn't want people to have their metal detectors and find this stuff. So, you know, I took that down in my, I didn't believe that that was what it was or the reason or anything, but that's what he said. So it's part of data for his worldview. That's how I understood it. And later, by the way, when I wrote about that part of it, my editor asked me to take it out. And she said, it just doesn't make any sense, Diana. Why would in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico be all this rubble on the ground? And I said, you're right. It doesn't make sense. I don't know why, but we have to leave it in because it was there. I saw it. Therefore, it's the data. So I had to convince her. And, you know, she was from Oxford University Press. So this is a press that only does peer-reviewed scholarship. So I have an obligation as a professor to collect all the data and then try to make sense of it. So I didn't have any way to make sense of that other than to suggest that this was part of his worldview for explaining that this was a real crash site. So that's how I, you know, that's really how I thought about it at the time. But regardless of my interpretation, this is data. So she was okay with that once I explained that to her. She was like, all right. You know, it was a, you know, the book got really uncomfortable for her at times too. And in fact, she was the one that wanted me to write it. But at times she was like, ah, oh, you can't say this. This is just too far into the belief category. And I was like, I'm not saying it. You know, these people are saying it. I'm reporting what they're saying. And she's like, okay, you know, as long as we're okay, as long as we know that. So anyway, so we went out there and it took us a while, but we did find stuff. We did find debris. And, you know, they did what good scientists do. They, you know, they had their gloves on and they put it in these little bags that they had and they dated it and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we continued to do that throughout the day. And then we came out with a good portion of this stuff that was really hard to get. It wasn't just lying on the surface. Like we had to first find it with the metal detectors and then dig for it and dig for it.
With their rigorous method of discovery established, the conversation now shifts to the intriguing claims surrounding government secrecy. Delving into the scrutiny of alleged artifacts and the skepticism that ensues.
Backyard, that's not what's going on.
So, you know, the for a skeptic listening to this conversation, the most far out claim potentially that they might hear is that, you know, the government is withholding confirmed alleged artifacts or even like biological evidence of aliens or alien bodies. So as you investigate this like whole phenomenon, like what do you make of those claims?
Yes, I'm with them. I'm with the skeptics. I think I have not seen any evidence of that. I know people who have said that we have evidence of that, but I'm a skeptic with respect to that too. We should be skeptical.
There's something to be said about like, yeah, the physical evidence of aliens. This is where like, if you really want to take an intellectual pursuit through the UFO phenomenon, you have to start making like all these distinctions because there's this kind of lumper category, this lumper of like everything's the same. And it's almost like you come into it with this narrative that you already have or you want to believe about what exactly is happening. And then you start making links between all these things. And this is one thing. And it's like this very specific type of alien is like invading our world on these aircrafts, and then they crash, and then we like retrieve the thing.
Right, right.
So one big thing that happened in the news that can be discussed publicly, because it went on record about this, if people are unfamiliar with David Grush's testimony, can you explain who he is, what he alleged, and like why that was controversial?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was at a congressional hearing in 2023, and he was a whistleblower. So he got whistleblower protections. Now, who is David Grush? So he is a decorated combat veteran, and he has worked for the Air Force and Air Force Intelligence for 14 years. So he has an impeccable record. He is an impeccable person, has impeccable credentials. And so he worked for what's called the NRO, which is the National Reconnaissance Office, as an intelligence officer, and the NGO, which is the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Your listeners most likely do not know what these are. So what these agencies do is they are our eyes in the sky, okay? So they're United States. The NRO takes care of the satellites that go up, reconnaissance satellites and things like that. It was secret for a long time. And if you've ever seen those, have you ever seen those patches, those mission patches? And they're totally weird looking, but they're cool also. Mm-hmm. So the NRO all has these patches that they release when they put a satellite up, and their mission patches. And then the NGO is, so the NRO gets the data and the NGO interprets it. Okay, so these are the people, we're in space a lot. Okay, so there's a space race happening. And so these two agencies are super important. They're for us, for the United States. So David Grush is an intelligence officer with respect to these two agencies, and he works between them. So he has access to what is being seen when we send satellites up, and he has access to what is being interpreted about what, you know, what we see up there, like the NDAs that we talked about earlier that the astronauts have.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So this is what he alleges. All right. So he says that, and by the way, I'm actually really happy that Dave Grush talked to Congress and got whistleblower status and so forth. Because to tell you the truth, when I did the first book, American Cosmic, I was just a professor doing this work, didn't know about these communities, did not, you know, I was really shocked to find out that aerospace people took it seriously. Hmm. More than that, I was shocked to find out that people that I was interviewing were part of this program, okay, which I didn't have any words for.
Having uncovered the complexities of Grush's insights, attention shifts toward the personal transformations reported by individuals following extraordinary experiences. These changes reveal a deeper understanding of what truly matters in life.
They report these effects. Whether or not we can prove them is another question. But this is what they report. They report that the things that they thought were important before are not important now. You know, like maybe they were, you know, focused on buying a lot of really nice cars or something. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that, by the way. And then, but their focus changes to like being a, you know, they like some people I've known who have near-death experiences become, you know, help starving people, right? And that's what they just focus on that. You know, people who are hungry, they feed them and, you know, wherever the need is. So they have a life change. So you do see this. You also have people report, you know, the non-ordinary knowing of things. Again, we can't, you know, I can't prove any of that, but that's what they report happens to them. So these are some of the things that happen after they have these events.
That really dives into what kind of many leading researchers you write about. They don't actually see this potentially as a physical extraterrestrial phenomenon. They see it as something kind of stranger, which would, I guess, bleed into what you would typically call a more spiritual lens with this phenomena. And so can you explain why so many people frame it that way and kind of what that tells us about the nature of the phenomenon?
So it's a there are degrees, which is why Alan Hynek came up with the, you know, close encounter of the third kind, of the first kind, of the second kind, of third kind, and then other people kind of changed that just recently. So, you know, because there are so many degrees of these sightings, and you can't, they're all not the same. Like you just talked about Miley Cyrus's sighting, right? Well, that looks pretty much like a physical sighting of a craft. Maybe there was a radar that picked that up. You know, multiple people saw it from different cars, and she saw a being of some sort. Okay, that's going to be different than the UFO kind of abduction narrative where a person's in bed and all of a sudden they're surrounded by these gray beings and they can't move and they want to get out and they're terrified. And then somehow they're taken into a place where there's a light like this, by the way, and, you know, they're subject to being examined by these beings and so forth. And, you know, this is a terrible thing and they want to get out and, you know, they're horrified and they don't like this. So that's very different, right? So that's kind of, is that a dream experience? You know, it happens in bed a lot. I don't know. I've not had that happen, but I've met people who have and I believe them and they don't want that to happen to them, you know?
Yeah. So some of the most credible voices on record, like we mentioned, Jacques Vallée is one of them, suggested that whatever these beings that people see are interdimensional. What does he mean by that?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a catch-all for we don't know. You know, it doesn't look physical, but it happens. Okay, so I'm going to give you an example of an anomalous phenomena that happens to Teresa of Avila. In the 1500s, she's a doctor of the church. She was a nun. And I'm not going to say this was a UFO experience, but it was an anomalous experience that has pattern matches to modern day report. Okay. So what does happen to her? So she is in a convent and she prays a lot. And at one point, and she, by the way, she wrote this down because she could write. So she wrote it down in her diary. And so what happens is that a being shows up that's about 3 feet tall to her left, and she doesn't know what it is.
Having delved into Teresa's extraordinary encounter, the scene shifts towards the tangible impact these experiences have on witnesses, as we explore the profound after effects that linger long after such phenomena.
I think it's interesting if you observe the people that actually went through the things, because it's like, it doesn't just stay at the level of like at some level, you and I are like, theorizing right now, yes, and like just discussing, yeah, the data,
yeah,
but it's very different for like someone to actually go through the experience and for it to be like an embodied experience. And now I'm just carrying this for the rest of my life. And then you have these like after effects that happens. And I kind of wanted to pull that apart because, you know, you mentioned this thing a couple times, which is that witnesses and researchers often report the strange feeling that once you become aware that there's a phenomenon, it becomes aware of you. So if you could put that into words, like what are they saying there?
Yeah, actually, so an author that really gets to this point, and there was a movie made about one of his books called The Mothman Prophecies, mm-hmm, and this is John Keel. And he's fascinating, by the way. Be careful if you read his work, because he's not a historian. His scholarship is, you know, he's not a scholar. But he actually does field research, and his work I find to be compelling for the fact that he's looking at the effects that this has on people, and he thinks it's terrible. So basically, he says, don't study this if you can help it. In the Mothman Prophecies, there's a cameo of him. It's not actually him, but it's a character based on him. Mm-hmm. And so the Richard Gere character, if anybody's interested, watch this movie. It's the Mothman Prophecies. It's an old movie, but it really does actually get at this idea that once you start studying it, it takes notice of you, right? I think even he said that. And by the way, somebody, Friedrich Nietzsche, who's a philosopher, has nothing to do with UFOs, but he also has something very similar where he says, you know, once you stare into the abyss will stare back, right? So it's one of his famous quotes. And it's this idea that once one becomes aware of, I would call it like non-ordinary reality, which Nietzsche did become aware of, but he was very careful not to become a believer, like a spirit, you know, that it was somehow spiritual, mm-hmm. you know, and things like that. So he practiced like a hygiene with respect to it, which is what I think John Keel does too. So he has this idea that once, because he studied this, he said that a friend of his started to study angels and then he was bedeviled by angels, like, you know, for 10 years of his life, you know, all these like angel events would happen to him and stuff just because he was studying this topic. So John Keel studies UFOs, Men in Black, Bigfoot, you know, all of these very weird things. And once he started to do this, his life became filled with weird coincidences and strange happenings, Men in Black type of things and everything like that. And he writes about it with humor, very dark humor, but humor nonetheless. And so this is an element that's actually, I would say, it's an experience that people have that, you know, once they truly get into this type of thing, a lot of things happen like that to them. The Men in Black thing happened to Gary, you know? So, yeah.
I mean, how does that awareness, like, connect to the paranormal or spiritual after effects that people experience? Are those two connected in any way? Like the awareness piece and the after effects?
Yeah. So it seems to be the same, I guess, once one becomes a hyper aware of it, then let me give you an example. Okay, so Kenneth Arnold, you know, he's one of the first big, you know, UFO, it's a big sighting, right? So he actually wrote a book about it. And for him, it changed his life in a very spiritual way. But it also brought a lot of these very strange synchronicities, coincidences, things that he couldn't really understand. These things started to happen to him. And he writes about it in his book. So there's an updated version of the book, by the way, by his, I think it's his granddaughter. And so he talks about this too. You know, he's just a pilot, a normal guy. And then he has this sighting. And then after the sighting, he has these effects. One of them is that he had done an interview with some people in this house about his sighting. And a couple days later, he went back to the house to get something that he thought he left there.
As the conversation touches on profound shifts in perception following extraordinary experiences, the focus shifts to the elusive realm of dimensions beyond our understanding and the intricate insights that may arise from them.
We could probably get our heads around that. So I think it's this other aspect that's so difficult to talk about because we don't really have any language to talk about it with, you know, these other dimensions and, you know, what are people experiencing when they've passed away and they come back and they say, no, this happened to me and I, you know, have this information that's veridical, right? That's, you can verify. Yeah, I think we're just at the very beginning of understanding that. I think religious traditions actually have information about that, but we tend to discount them. So, you know, during the 1700s and so forth, we have the Enlightenment, right? Where we kind of like discard a lot of wisdom from previous, you know, religious traditions for whatever reason, right? We have our reasons for doing that. And so a lot of those traditions probably have interesting information for us. So in the 1980s, a scientist, a physicist at, I believe it was at UC Berkeley, wrote The Tao of Physics. And he basically said, look, you know, these guys were onto it way back in the day, right? Okay. Yeah, Taoism, you know, and it perfectly describes this quantum world, which we're learning about now. So there's a lot of history that we could actually go back into and say, ah, this makes sense. Kind of like what the aerospace people are doing with me, you know. What you're saying about Joseph Cupertino, that actually makes sense to this. Let's get more information.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because, you know, if you do look at these things like religious traditions, like there is some sort of information that, like data, like you said, or like what is being communicated here. I mean, there's instances where, like, even if you, I guess you take the Bible or something like that, like, there are a segment of scholars who would say there isn't one thing on the other side of a physical reality, right? Like there's God, but like there are other beings that are on the other side. Like, and that might not be equal like with God, but like there are other things on their side. So when you look at these, I mean, Hinduism is another example where like there's room for multiple things that
multiple worlds
are on, yeah, that are on the other side. And so I think it kind of opens up the possibilities of what exactly is being, you know, interacted with. I mean, Gary Nolan went on the Jordan Peterson podcast a few months ago, and he explicitly said the line that something non-human is here and it has been here for a long time. When you hear that, what do you feel like he means?
Yeah. So he and I have, of course, talked about the history of, you know, the history of the framework of demons, angels, and these things that populate the other world. And he did say, when we were out in the desert, actually, he said, you know, Diana, if this was 100 years ago, we'd be talking about demons and angels, you know? So I think that's what he's talking about. He's referencing that there could be presences that we are now detecting and have been here, and people back in the day detected them too by other means, perhaps.
Which with that line is just so striking, because if you look at how Gary moves, and I've, you know, in preparation for this interview, I just like studied kind of his posture and his mentality. He's so cautious to say anything, even the way that he looks at data and not making like premature judgments on things, and then also correcting himself like if he got something wrong. And I think that goes back to like the credibility thing. When you see someone who has reached the highest levels of academia and is like one of the most preeminent scientists in his field in the world, like come out and say something, it puts more credence to the subject, because there's been so much study and analysis that has went into making a statement. It's not like I'm just saying things because I just want to say it. You know?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody in academia, I'm speaking from experience, would actually do this if we didn't have a lot of information and data that backed us up. Like, you know, why would I do that? I was already at the chair of my department, a full professor. It didn't make sense for me to come out and do this kind of study publicly, you know, unless I believed that there was something to be studied.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the way that I wanted to kind of close is to like, how do we implicate the listener in some sort of way? And like, what I mean by that is like from the stories that you've collected, like what's the most striking way you've seen someone's life change after an encounter? Like, how they see their purpose, their relationships, or potentially even death differently.
Okay, so I won't name names, right?
Reflecting on the profound impact of personal experiences, the discussion shifts to real-life stories, where encounters have transformed individuals' understanding of purpose, relationships, and even belief systems, unveiling powerful narratives that resonate deeply.
Backed us up. Like, you know, why would I do that? I was already at the chair of my department, a full professor. It didn't make sense for me to come out and do this kind of study publicly, you know, unless I believed that there was something to be studied.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the way that I wanted to kind of close is to like, how do we implicate the listener in some sort of way? And like, what I mean by that is like from the stories that you've collected, like what's the most striking way you've seen someone's life change after an encounter, like how they see their purpose, their relationships, or potentially even death differently?
Okay, so I won't name names, right? But I have seen a person who is a professional and experienced what they didn't know what it was, actually. And then through talking to people like me, Gary, Jacques, you know, people like that, Leslie Kane, understood that what they experienced was what we study, and then thought back into their life and recognized that this had been something that they have experienced their whole life. And in fact, even their grandparents had these experiences. And this shifted their life so much that they became convinced that they actually went back to their religion. So they had been, you know, they had been born and raised in a specific religion. And then they, you know, like a lot of people kind of like that's how I was raised, but I don't believe that, you know, but I'm a good person and went along with their life. And then once something tangible happened to them, something that they could say, this is real, it confirmed their religion for them. They were like, oh, this is actually what they were talking about. Now I see, I better change my life. So they literally changed their life. They became a better person. There's a saying in Christianity, get your life in order. Mm-hmm. They got their life in order.
What, you know, you have been doing this for like 13 years after studying this. How has this whole process impacted you and shaped you over the past 13 years?
Yeah. So it's been a rocky kind of road because of everything that's happened. It's been really exhilarating too, though, because I did this not knowing that the government was going to, you know, come out and disclose and, you know, have these congressional hearings and so forth. Not at all. So I was very surprised. I was doing something that is done in my field, which is looking at emerging beliefs, new religious movements. So it wasn't out of the ordinary for someone to do this in my field. But there's no way I could have predicted all the things that happened. And also meeting aerospace community people who believe in it and study it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then being exposed to all the different theories. I would say that it was, that it hasn't changed my life. Yeah, of course, absolutely has changed my life. And it has reconfirmed a lot of what I studied. I'm a geeky kid, right? I was a geeky kid. So I read a lot of philosophy as a kid. I read a lot of Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophy. I read a lot of Kierkegaard. I read a lot of theology. And to me, this is just a continuation of that. If you read all that and it doesn't influence you in some way, I can't imagine that. Well, first, why would you read that, right? So it's going to influence you. So I'm with Socrates, which he said that the unexamined life is, you know, the examined life is worth living. I don't want to say it the way he said it, but the examined life is definitely worth living.
Well, what do you think would change in our society or has changed in society's past if the majority of people started living like this dimension isn't all there is?
Oh, we have a completely wonderful place to live. It would be just great. Oh, listen, I was 18. I was in college. I was taking physics. It was hard. My physics professor was like a chain smoker, but he was a character and I really liked him. And he would say things to me that I couldn't believe, but I then verified. He would say, we already have electric cars. Now, this is a long time ago, right? I was 18. And he'd say, you know, Diana, we have the technology to make this world a beautiful place. And I always was under the impression that the only reason we didn't make it a beautiful place was because there were things that were bad. But what I recognized was it was people that were bad. It wasn't just circumstances. There are hurricanes, you know, and there are things like that that are natural kind of disasters, right? But they're not evil. So once I started to realize that we're messing it up for ourselves, that's when I started to get interested in philosophy and religion. So I left physics. Physics was fun, you know, but it was a physics professor who told me this. So if we actually believed that there were consequences for our actions, like, you know, Socrates was trying to make people in his day believe that, you know, if we actually had that experience and we had an experience of an otherworldly intelligence that in a sense slapped us awake, you know, I think we'd have a wonderful place to live. And I do think we have a wonderful place to live.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.